You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Erin Wagermiller. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, February 6th, 2018.
And basically, if a person doesn't demonstrate that they are working or that they meet another list of exemptions, they will lose their health care coverage.
Coming up in the next half hour, we'll hear from Jesse Cross Call, Senior Policy Analyst for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. Cross Call speaks with WFHB News Director Wes Martin about the Department of Health and Human Services' decision on Friday to extend Indiana's Medicaid exemptions and about the increasing role of Indiana politics in the national health care debate. That interview is coming up later on the Daily Local News in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Maddie Fuller came to Bloomington and her family in the aftermath of the American Civil War. Fuller became one of the most celebrated and recognized African Americans in Monroe County's history. We'll hear excerpts from her diaries and correspondences in this week's edition of The Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
A bill before the state legislature that would have done away with some 300 townships across Indiana failed in the State House last night. The General Assembly did not call the bill to a vote before the midnight deadline last night. The bill would have forced the consolidation of townships with populations under 1,200 residents. The Associated Press reports House Speaker Brian Bosma as saying the bill did not have enough support from Republican lawmakers to be called up for a vote. Republicans hold a supermajority in Indiana, comprising the majority of the state Senate and state House representatives, as well as the governor's office. Advocates of the bill stated that doing away with over a quarter of the state's townships would have limited government waste. But Purdue economist Larry DeBoer says those cost savings would have been minimal.
In terms of the amount of money that can be saved, it's really not that much. The total budgets of all the townships, less than 1,200 people, is $17 million out of $17 billion that we spend on local government altogether. So it's 0.1% of the amount that we spend on local government is the maximum amount that could be saved. And as you said, it's conceivable we wouldn't save anything.
DeBoer says townships are arguably the most local form of governance in the state. Their primary duties include the allocation of taxes to rural fire departments and the dispensation of welfare to the poor.
The proposal for a waste transfer station on Bloomington's northwest side was officially withdrawn today. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management notified the city of Bloomington's legal department this morning that Indiana Green Transfer and Recycling's proposal for a permit was withdrawn. The proposed waste transfer station, which would have collected garbage and recycling for sorting and transportation, drew anger from residents along North Angelina Lane. Residents repeatedly told local government administrators the increased traffic, pollution, and noise from the proposed site was unacceptable. Indiana Green Transfer and Recycling Company owner Jeff Fagno notified Monroe County commissioners of his decision not to pursue a local permit by email last week. In the three-line email, Fagno stated the decision is based on, quote, the remonstrance our proposal generated, unquote, and he apologizes for the turmoil it created. According to the Department of Environmental Protection, Indiana Green Transfer and Recycling applied to IDEM for a transfer facility permit in late September. County Councilman Shelley Yoder submitted the company's proposal to IDEM, but withdrew her fiscal responsibility with the company following public backlash. Area residents and business owners learned of the proposal through IDEM in October. Some were also concerned a waste facility would deter cleaner businesses from locating to the area. The residents-turned-activists consistently showed up at meetings of the county council, county commissioners, and the plan commission, pressuring officials to take a stand against the proposal. However, the proposal never came before county officials for review. This morning's withdrawal of the IDEM permit request for the facility ends the push for the site on North Angelina Lane.
The Monroe County Election Board approved creating two new polling places in its February 1st meeting. The board is eliminating polling sites at the IU football complex and the IU Union Center in favor of one central polling site at the University Club. Board member Carolyn Vanderweel and William Ellis said the site visit proved the University Club is the best option for a central polling place.
It's a very nice room. It has very nice parking. Parking will be free in the union lot for all able-bodied drivers. You'll get a sticker that says you voted. That's a particular IU sticker, so it's going to become a collector item. But they will then waive your parking for at the gate. There are also quite a few disabled parking spots actually in front of the University Club, right, with a fairly short access to the club, and they have power door and all that stuff. So I think that makes a very good site. The only sort of one little drawback is the fact there's no separate egress, so people will cross each other coming out, but I don't think that's going to be a big issue.
The University Club room will be a polling site for precincts Bloomington 5th, 18th, 19th, and 23rd districts. Sandy Shapshay is the director of IU's Political and Civil Engagement Program. She says research indicates a central campus polling site is crucial to increasing student voter turnout.
And I promise we will do our part now to really try to beat Purdue at voting and get our IU students registered and motivate them to go out there and do their civic duty and take part in our shared democratic government.
According to Election Supervisor Karen Wheeler, the First Church of the Nazarene will not be able to host voting in 2018. Wheeler and Vanderveel say the Academy for Science and Entrepreneurship replaced the church as a polling site.
There's a large entrance hallway into the cafeteria, which is actually where you enter the building. It's a wide open cafeteria. It's light. It's a really nice space. And they answered all of our questions as far as accessibility. They have Wi-Fi contacts. They also have excellent parking. There are two ADA spots out front, two more around the corner with fairly close access. And then there's probably at least 40 parking spaces in their lot for other people to park. So I was very pleased with it. In fact, it's, I think, a really nice site.
Clerk Nicole Brown thanked the First Church of the Nazarene for providing a polling site for many years. Brown, Ellis, and Vanderweel expressed their hopes for a strong voter turnout this fall. The next meeting of the Monroe County Election Board is scheduled for March 1st.
The League of Women Voters of Bloomington and Monroe County is inviting the public to its second legislative update on Saturday. The League's first update included presentation by District 60 Representative Peggy Mayfield, District 62 Representative Jeff Ellington, District 61 Representative Matt Pierce, and District 40 State Senator Mark Stoops. The next legislative update takes place on February 10th from 9:30 to 11 a.m. The event will be held in the Bloomington City Council chambers. Monroe County legislators are expected to discuss developments in the Indiana General Assembly and will include public comment and question. This is the second of three legislative updates planned by the League. All updates will be held in the Bloomington City Council chambers are open to the public. The updates will be available for later viewing through Community Access Television Services at catstv.net. The first legislative update is available on standing room only at WFHB.org.
The 100 block of Kirkwood Avenue could look decidedly more modern when an empty parking lot next to CVS is replaced with a condominium project. The City of Bloomington's case manager, James Roach, described the project in last night's Bloomington Plan Commission meeting.
It's a very modern design, very sleek. It's clad in brick, limestone, and glass.
The proposed development will contain more than 2,000 square feet of commercial space on the bottom, with 16 condominiums above. Plans call for a 19-space parking garage for tenants and three new curbside spaces. The project petitioner, real estate lawyer Randy Lloyd, says the condos will be custom designed for owner occupancy. The site plan presented last night is a revision of the original submitted in November. Roach says planning staff could not positively recommend the first plan because it was well over height and density restrictions. Roach says that plan was altered to bring the building down from 5 stories to 4 and the number of units down from 22 to 16. Roach says the developer also committed to adding more green elements,
including things such as very high efficiency systems and electric car charging stations within the parking garage.
However, Roach says the current site plan still contains code violations. The structure is 16 feet taller than surrounding historic structures, with more units per acre than current building code allows.
They've done quite a bit to make the design more palatable, change the design to fit in a little better with the historic surroundings, including the height and the massing. But is it enough? Is this building asking too much of the Plan Commission for 16 feet taller than typical and more dense and taller than the historic building next door? So those are all issues we're still struggling with. We would like another month to continue to work with the petitioner.
After review and discussion, Plan Commission members largely voiced support for the project, though they did not give their final approval.
Commission member Susan Sandberg says she is impressed the condos would be owner-occupied as opposed to rentals. She also says she's pleased more time and consideration will be given to the design.
I guess what I would hope for is maybe just a little more charm. I mean, when you compare it to the tree canopy across the street and the beauty of the Buskirk-Chumley side of the street, if there could be a few more elements that would make it appear a little bit more charming and a little less sleek.
As for the ways the site plan does not comply with UDO standards, Sandberg says she doesn't think it's that far off base. Plan Commission President Joe Hoffman says he expects some will say the building's design doesn't fit with the historic buildings nearby.
You know, our downtown is also eclectic. It's not everything looking the same. And the CBS building right next door is basically Art Deco. So we've jumped a century already from the beginning of the Courthouse Square to the CBS building. This is moving us into the next 100 years. I think it's great.
The commission agreed to give planning staff and the developer more time to tweak the site plan. The project will come before the Plan Commission again on March 5th. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Erin Wagermiller. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
On Friday, U.S. Health and Human Services approved Indiana's request to impose additional requirements on Medicaid recipients in the state. The approval makes Indiana one of only two states that require residents receiving Medicaid to have a job. Kentucky has applied for similar stipulations. Jesse Cross Call, senior policy analyst for the D.C.-based Nonpartisan Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, says the approval took place even though Indiana's own evaluations concluded that additional requirements for Medicaid recipients made them less likely to continue to have health care coverage. The approval comes after the former president of Eli Lilly Pharmaceuticals, Alex Avar, was appointed as the Secretary of Health and Human Services. CrossCall says the approval of Indiana's additional requirements for residents to get Medicaid highlights the state's growing influence over national health care policy. Here is Jesse CrossCall of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities speaking with WFHB News Director Wes Martin.
In 2015, Indiana expanded its Medicaid program as part of the Affordable Care Act. There are 32 states that have taken up that option. When they did it, they were one of the states that did it through a waiver, which means that they did it in a way that allowed them to sort of modify the terms under which they would expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. And the name of their program, the name of their waiver, is the Healthy Indiana Plan. That waiver extended for 3 years, so it had to be reauthorized. And last Friday, HHS extended Indiana's Medicaid expansion waiver for another 3 years, but they made some changes to the waiver. So in addition to the way that KIPP has been operating for the past 3 years, HHS allowed Indiana to become the second state, joining Kentucky, in imposing a work requirement on the Hoosiers who get their health care through the Medicaid expansion.
And what does that mean, a work requirement, in order to get Medicaid?
So this is something that's never been allowed before in Medicaid under Democrat or Republican administrations, and that is conditioning eligibility for Medicaid on working a certain number of hours a month. Medicaid is a health care program that provides health care services to low-income and vulnerable populations across the country, such as seniors, people with disabilities, children. This work requirement would apply to Hoosiers, adult Hoosiers who are in the Medicaid expansion, and so that is single adults and parents as well. And basically, if a person doesn't demonstrate that they are working or that they meet another list of exemptions, they will lose their health care coverage.
And just to be perfectly clear, that means that poor people in Indiana, in order to go along with the Affordable Care Act expansion in 2015, that means that Indiana put a number of stipulations on going along with that. Is that a correct summarization?
Yeah. So when Indiana originally expanded in 2015, their waiver was called the Healthy Indiana Plan. And it was different than the way that the other states in the country expanded Medicaid, in the sense that, A, people would be charged a premium, and if they did not pay the premium, they would either get a lesser benefit package if they had very low incomes, or if their incomes were above the poverty line and they missed their premium payments, they would lose coverage entirely. There were a number of other facets to this waiver, but that's sort of like the core structure of how Indiana structured its program. And so that's the construct under which Indiana has been operating its Medicaid expansion since 2015.
And it sounds like we're not alone in at least having a work requirement for people to be considered eligible for Medicaid in the state. You had mentioned Kentucky also has something like this. Can you elaborate a little bit about that?
Sure. So as I said, a work requirement has never been allowed in Medicaid before. HHS granted Kentucky the first work requirement, approval for the first work requirement a few weeks ago. That has not taken effect, and obviously Indiana's will not take effect immediately. Indiana's already is being litigated in court, because there is a strong case to be made that Medicaid is a health insurance program and that there is nothing in the Medicaid statutes that allows HHS to condition eligibility on whether or not somebody is working.
Just to switch gears here for a second, can you talk a little bit about what some of your findings were, or at least what the state's findings were when it came to these different requirements that were put on Hoosiers who were applying for Medicaid under the state expansion Healthy Indiana Plan and HIP 2.0?
So as part of a waiver, a state needs to come up with a hypothesis, something that they're testing, and then along the way they have to do some evaluations of that waiver to see if they are meeting their hypothesis, to basically if their hypothesis is true. So back in 2015, when Indiana expanded Medicaid with its Healthy Indiana plan, they were testing premiums and how assessing premiums on people would change their behavior, specifically around whether they would maintain coverage and how it would impact their use of preventive services. So along the way, Indiana, like I said, has had to do evaluations of how the waiver is working. And there is data that showed that 60,000 people with incomes above the poverty line who missed premium payments did not enroll in coverage or did not maintain their coverage. So that's 60,000 people who dropped Medicaid coverage because of the premium. And then there's also, for the people below the poverty line who missed their premium payments, they got put into a less comprehensive benefit package. And those individuals, the evaluations show, are less likely to use preventative care services, are more likely to visit an emergency room than people with the more comprehensive benefit package. And what we think that this shows is that Healthy Indiana's construction has harmed people with its premium assessments on people has actually harmed beneficiaries because it has caused tens of thousands of them to not maintain their Medicaid coverage. And for those who are able to maintain their coverage, they are less likely to get the care that they need.
About 60,000 people had dropped coverage. And out of how many in Indiana, roughly?
About 400,000 people.
Mr. Crosscall, if we can shift topics a little bit here yet again. Seema Verma, who was also up for, or at least was widely spoken of in being in consideration for the director position of Health and Human Services, which we've just seen go to Mr. Avar, the former CEO of Eli Lilly in Indiana. Seema Verma was instrumental in getting the Healthy Indiana plan and these Medicaid exemptions and requirements passed for the state. Now that we see Mr. Avar in the director position of Health and Human Services, does that seem like Indiana is kind of at the center of healthcare and Health and Human Services agencies?
Yeah, there's definitely a Indiana influence on HHS, and not just Seema Verma, but some other employees that came from Indiana, and obviously Vice President Pence. You know, the state expanded Medicaid when he was governor. And Seema Verma, prior to joining the administration, she consulted with Indiana on its waiver, and she consulted on with Kentucky when they were putting together their waiver proposal. She was supposed to have recused herself from consideration about whether or not to approve Kentucky or Indiana, and it appears that she did recuse herself. But it's also very apparent that this HHS and this CMS is encouraging states to bend the Medicaid rules to make it harder for people to maintain coverage, and so that we expect that to continue to be apparent as future waivers are considered by CMS.
Coming up next, WFHB's weekly segment celebrating 200 years of South Central Indiana history, the Bicentennial Journal.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is our Monroe County story. My name is Gladys DeVay.
And I'm Elizabeth Mitchell.
Among the many African Americans headed north after the Civil War in search of a better life was a little girl named Martha Susan Pierce, known to us as Mattie Jacobs Fuller. She crossed the Ohio River from Kentucky with her parents and seven siblings around 1867.
I remember hearing music as we crossed the river. It was coming from a banjo. An old man sat there and just kept plucking on that banjo, making the happiest music I ever heard. It made me feel real good all over. Folks were smiling and nodding just like they knowed you. I believe that's when I fell in love with music. Ain't it funny the things you remember? I was only 6 years old when we crossed that river. Mama died of a heart attack soon after we got to Bloomington, Papa couldn't take care of all of us. But I was blessed, because Dr. and Miss Durant took me in. I was bound out to them. That mean I worked for them for food and a place to stay. Miss Durant was good to me. She paid for me to go down to Louisville and take a course in hairdressing, where I learned to make skin lotion and vanishing cream. I had one of the first beauty shops in Bloomington. Folks would come to my beauty shop, and I'd fix them up real pretty. And the ones that couldn't come, I'd go to them. I made a pretty good living, and I created quite a name for myself. Miss Durant also paid for me to have music lessons with the best teacher in Bloomington. That's right, music lessons. I took to the piano right quick, and I could sing, too. Folks used to go out of their way to tell me, "Maddie, you got such a beautiful voice." They loved to hear me sing. So I bought a little folding organ and set that organ up right out there on the courthouse square in downtown Bloomington. And I put out my loving cup. I played, and the people coming by would stop and listen. Honey, I played and they paid. And every penny I give to my church, Bethel AME, you know, right there on the corner of 7th and Rogers, I paid for the lot that church sitting on. My loving cup was given to me by the people of my church in appreciation for the money I raised. I raised $13,000. I was also the first colored person in Monroe County to get a telephone. Back then, it was something to have your own telephone. They wrote about me in the paper, you know, in the section called Among the Colored. They'd say things like, "Maddie Jacobs is the first colored to get her own telephone." Or they'd say, "Maddie Jacobs sang at the 56th anniversary for Wim Arnold. She sang beautiful." They even wrote about my marriage. The surprise in high-colored society of today is the news that Maddie Jacobs was united in marriage to Levi B. Fuller. The mayor tied the nuptial knot good and hard. But honey, let me tell you, he didn't tie that knot hard enough, because the marriage didn't last but a split second. There was even times that I'd write to the paper so that the people back home would know that I was having a good time. The paper would report, "Maddie Jacobs Fuller writes to the telephone that she's having a good time at Bethany Park." You know, I think that made some of them just a little jealous. I can truly say God's been good to me. I come here with nothing, and I made a decent life for myself. Now, don't get me wrong. I had my share of ups and downs, and life wasn't always easy in this town for folks like me. But I made a pretty good life for myself here, and I raised a lot of money for my church. My first love is God, and my second love is music.
Maddie Jacobs Fuller, born around 1860, died 1940. A lifelong resident of Bloomington, a woman devoted to God, and dedicated to making music that gave him praise. A woman of determination, a woman of character, a woman of resilience.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from the Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welsh, along with Joyce Poling. Our engineer is Megan Wade. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmadke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Erin Wagermiller.
And I'm Don Guerra. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming, online at wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio.
Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a daily local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcasts of the daily local news Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.